Ideas are powerful things. Ideas are more powerful than any king, any army, any nation. An idea, the right idea, can transcend time and place, worm its way into the minds of others, spread more virulently than any plague. An idea can cause wars and much worse. And the most potent delivery system of any idea is the book. A book can change the world by conveying ideas within it that can radicalize, traumatize, and transform entire civilizations. History is replete with such books. The Gospels are an example of such a book. The Holy Quran is another. In later days, books like, Paine's The Rights of Man, Hobbes' Leviathan, Darwin's On the Origin of Species, Marx's Das Kapital, each of these would contain within their pages concepts that changed the way people viewed the world, implanted ideas which transformed those who heard them or read them, and articulating and creating new dynamics in the world around them. What I find most wonderful is that once upon a time, London had such a book. A book that was to become, for a short while, the most important text in the city. Men will die over this book, and the city itself is about to be torn into two because of it. A book known as the Jubilee. Years ago, when I first started getting into the history of this city I love so much, I knew nothing about this book, knew nothing about it, the reasons for it, the ideas it contained, the passions it generated. I stumbled upon it amazed, and suddenly events around it began to make more sense for me. The book provided a narrative theme around which the city itself seemed to hang. In many ways, the genesis of the entire project called The Story of London was begun when I realised I desperately wished to tell the story of this book and the ideas within it. And so starting now are a series of episodes about London during the time of this book called The Jubilee. A dozen years where London was to become a world unto itself. There is much going on, the death of a king, a huge rebellion, religious fanatics and more, and each of these will gain their focus as London becomes the stage upon which these themes take their places in the grand drama of history. But the book is always there. The book and the reasons behind it must be told. We begin its story with the last few years of the reign of Edward III, the mighty and terrible King of England, the glorious victor of the war against France, now reduced to a frail old man. And around him, vultures began to circle and mere anarchy crept upon the land. We are sliding into political chaos and will spare no mercy in trying to convey the complexity and depth of the politics of London. New factions are about to be created with men who had become political giants in the city and whose story needs to be told. Hi, my name is Saul and this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of the city. Each episode supposedly stands alone in what I hope is an interesting slice of life, but taken together, they create a vast and epic narrative. Welcome then to this week's episode, the 130th chapter of this story, and the first part of the saga of the Jubilee. Welcome to Jesu Have Pity. King Edward III was going into decline. He was increasingly out of touch with the day-to-day running of his government and seemed cut off from the reality of the state. His intellectual capacity reached a point where you could clearly identify cognitive decline. Some historians maintain this was due to a series of strokes, and there is evidence that it was a stroke that finally killed him. But there remains a plethora of possible explanations as to his increasing cognitive frailty. And there are many degenerative diseases of the mind known today. It may have been dementia that the king began to suffer from. His boldness of old was lost, and he began making uncharacteristic mistakes. What kind of mistakes? Well, in August 1373, while at court in Woodstock, King Edward had given some jewels and fine treasures, which had once belonged to his late wife, Queen Philippa, to his royal mistress, the young, attractive, and if you are to believe the accounts of the time, utterly wicked and self-serving, Alice Perrers. At the time, giving his wife's jewels to his mistress was seen as an example of his immorality, done openly and tactlessly, and many saw this as the king's mistress seeking power or being indolent. But it was probably an elderly king granting his young bedwarmer gifts for her kindness and him no longer grasping the danger it put her in. The dread King Edward had gone from the young thunderbolt racing here and there to the glorious warlord whose army so terrorized Europe to now being an affable, smiling, white-bearded and forgetful old man. Not since another Edward, Edward the Confessor, had England been ruled like this. With King Edward increasingly incapable of governing, his senior courtiers assumed a greater role in the state. The Royal Chamberlain, towards the end of his reign, William Latimer, not only controlled access to this king, he began increasingly to prevent people from meeting him, isolating the old man. Eventually, little or no important business was brought to him. Latimer even developed a system whereby he was allowed to reply in the king's name to petitions addressed to him. Those holding office around the aging man began to seek to enrich themselves. They felt the king could die at any time. When he did, they also knew that they, in all probability, would be replaced. For men like Latimer, this meant they could not let too many opportunities to enrich themselves pass them by. Richard Leon, the man in charge of the Royal Mint, was a friend of the king's mistress, Alice Perrers, and he also suspected that he only had a short time to gather what endowment for his future he could. But the bottom line was, very suddenly, young Alice herself was in a dangerous position. Here was this aging and great king. He had been absolutely faithful to Queen Philippa, as far as we can tell, and had only taken Alice Perrers as his mistress towards the very end of his queen's life and since. And he was awarding his royal mistress robes, jewels, status, fame, authority over many servants. But she was no noble. He had singled her out for what she was herself, not because of her status or political connections. And as flattering as that was, Alice was being placed above the wives of knights, barons and earls. Normally, a royal mistress was lucky if she had her first bastard child recognized before she was cast aside. For Edward, not only did he know he had a bastard child by Alice, he kept her around. No other medieval king remained as faithful to a single mistress as long as Edward did to Alice. And yet Alice was intelligent enough to realize that her power and wealth was likely to be hanging by a thin thread. By 1372, she was having to think about what would happen to her when the old king was gone. What would she do when he was dead? He was already past 60. She had only a limited amount of time to safeguard her position and future. Hence, her starting to deal in property and her use of influence, which she was getting off her lover, to guarantee a future income. This simple act of survival was seen as the worst kind of corruption and nepotism by the rest of the king's court. The rumour spread around that a certain Dominican friar, who attended Alice as a physician, dabbled in magical cures and had given her the secret of a potion by which she could continue to bewitch the king. Yeah, Alice Perrers was clearly in danger. And so were those who became friends with the king's mistress. And one of these was the king's administrator over in the territories controlled by the English king in Ireland, a man called William Windsor. Now, Windsor had repeatedly been accused by the Irish of extortion, bribery, and a host of other financial crimes. He was, however, cleared of any wrongdoing in 1373. On balance of probability, probably because of Alice's intervention in the case. But he remained controversial and unpopular. The Irish pleaded for someone else to be sent to run their lands, and This seems to have been Edward's intention. Yet in the autumn of that year, someone persuaded Edward to send William Windsor back to Ireland. This decision was made less than 6 weeks after King Edward's gift of Alice of those controversial jewels which had first belonged to Queen Philippa. It does seem very likely that it was Alice who persuaded him to reinstate William Windsor. This is all the more probable when we consider that at this time, Alice and William were making property transactions together, and they were also up to even more because it's probable at this time that Alice and William secretly got married. And as ruthless as this seems, and certainly it was seen as a terrible betrayal of her lover the king, Alice Parr's actions reveal a desperate woman having to play the only card she could play. As soon as Edward died, she would be nothing and liable to attack from many political enemies. The rest of the royal family would happily throw her to the dogs. She needed some protection, any protection. Marrying William Windsor in secret was her once lifeline. But it was a secret for a while. She still played the attractive trophy mistress to the aging king. And the high point for me of Alice Parr's career as a royal mistress took place in London in 1375. Here she attended a tournament at Smithfield alongside the king. Ah, Smithfield tournaments. How London loved these displays of pageantry. But how far had they all come from the events of the years previously? As we covered back in chapter 118 with the great tournament on Cheapside, London adored the tournaments of Edward III. And while that one had ended in near disaster as the great grandstand which Queen Philippa had sat upon had collapsed, this time the king's young mistress rode from the Tower of London through the city dressed as the Lady of the Sun, to the frank amazement of the residents of London. Like the great Cheapside tournament almost three decades earlier, the ladies of the court led the knights on silver chains. But now the imagery took on a darker meaning with the feeling that the king's mistress was leading the king by a chain. King Edward began to seem wholly in a power. His world seems to have shrunk to his immediate horizons, his ambitions dissipated. He was conscious only of Alice, his household servants, and his few surviving family members. With them he participated in hunting, hawking, courtly entertainment. All else seems to have failed. All else now seemed unimportant to him. And to be blunt, to the rest of the country, they would not stand for this. They had some hope in the Prince of Wales, but his heir, Edward of Woodstock, known to us as Edward the Black Prince, may have been heir to the crown, but he was severely poorly. His eldest son, Edward of Angoulême, had died in 1371, the heir of the heir, and the Prince of Wales' health had deteriorated after that, forcing his return to England. He had recovered slightly, but he was too sick to attend the Parliament of 1376. This meeting, known to history as the Good Parliament, was one of the most explosive political events in English history, and certainly the most important Parliament to happen during the reign of Edward III. This was the Parliament that was being called so the king could ask for more taxes to be raised, so as to continue the renewed and clearly we are losing war in France. But for the members of that Parliament, they now had a chance to unleash their frustration at the men and women around the king, to express their unhappiness at the state of the realm. And for the London MPs who attended that Parliament in 1376, there was way more to their issues. Something deeper and greater was happening in the city. A political crisis was emerging, the like of which it had never seen before. To understand why, we just need to go back a few years. In the summer of 1369, the city of London again faced the loss of all protection against foreign competition, when free trade was imposed upon them once again. The Londoners did petition Parliament soon afterwards for the restoration of the full franchise of the city, But this was swept away by the drumbeats of war. The crown needed money, quick money, and so it restored the wool staples or wool markets of England, which placed the balance of trade firmly into the hands of foreigners. Foreign merchants, Germans and especially Italians, could now buy wool from England and pay for it with the profits made from selling masses of European goods in England, and English merchants simply could not compete, or they were forbidden from competing. At the same time as this, the king pardoned the main Italian merchant who'd been going around for the few years previously trying to cut out all English merchants from the retail trade. A man who'd been found guilty in London of multiple frauds and sharp deals that enriched himself at the expense of the residents. A man from the city of Lucca called Nicholas Sarducci. He, even though he was convicted in London, was pardoned. And the pardoning of Sarducci made the king's policy plain. Nothing would be done to impede the Italian merchants who could supply the crown with much needed cash. The needs of the merchants of England and London in particular, these were now secondary. We covered this to a degree in chapter 128. London's merchant class was divided in its reaction to these events. But for all of them, all factions, all vested interests in London, the renewal of the war in 1369 was a political watershed. London would never be the same again. New political factions now arose. The first immediately saw the war and the changes it brought as a way of making more money by aligning themselves with the crown, or in particular with those around the aging and dementia suffering king. Two of London's senior aldermen, John Peche and Adam de Berry, had partly built their fortunes on royal service and finance, and they led this group. A new alderman, the mercer John Pale, was included in this group, and he, like Peche, was a tenant of John of Gaunt and one of his closest friends. Peche was able to draw on enough support in the Court of Aldermen to be elected a Member of Parliament back in 1369, and he provided the leadership for this court party in the city, which was, for the king and his manipulators, a group they could look to support as the war imposed new economic and political strains on the government of London. Included in this group was the Master of the Royal Mint, Richard Lyon. For other aldermen, particularly the powerful group of fishmongers who'd become wool exporters, the war and this new policy posed an existential threat to their prosperity. They had profited from the old mandatory selling of English wool in the Calais staple, and like grocers, they had imported raw materials from the cloth industry as return cargoes. Now they were banned from this trade and had to watch its profits swell the capital of Italians. And on top of this, with the renewal of war, they could expect their ships to be commandeered by the king for his military expeditions. In November 1368, they were led on the aldermanic bench by William Woolworth, a fishmonger and wool merchant who had decided that this faction needed political power to protect their interests. The influence of the fishmongers was clearly responsible for the election of two of their number, a man called Exton and a man called Turngold, by the commonalty and the aldermen respectively, as the other members of the Parliament of 1369. That Exton, we've already seen, had been willing to use violence. You may remember back towards the end of chapter 127, I mentioned the Giles Pikeman case, where a whole bunch of fishmongers, possibly based in Southwark, were bound over in 1365 after trying to kill and then nearly killing this other fishmonger called Giles Pikeman. I did say in that episode I would try to find out more about the Pikeman case. Well, I have. While Pikeman is described as a citizen and a fishmonger, and damn near 30 other fishmongers, I speculated, could have been non-citizens who attacked him because he was impeding on their trade, well, it turns out that actually some of the offenders were London citizens, and the cause of the vendetta was a bit more complex. It was probably linked to the internal feud within the fishmongers, possibly between those who were aligned towards what would become the court faction and those who became leading members of the opposition to it. And we can say that when the authorities bound over Nicholas Exton to keep the peace because of his threats to murder Giles Pikeman, Nicholas had none other than Nicholas Brembe standing as surety for him. And 3 years later, as we said, Nicholas Exton became an MP. So assume this MP was also a man with a record of violence and was aligned to William Woolworth's new faction, a faction that had made their fortunes because of the wool market or the staple of Calais. And we can use this case to show that William Woolworth's new faction began to gather rich supporters, and from them, political power. Consider that at the beginning of 1369, the grocers were represented by only one alderman, the long-serving roper Bartholomew Festling. Other rich pepperers and ropers like William Venor, Fulk Harwood, William Barrett and John Aubrey had been focused during the decade previously on just making money and had shown zero inclination to ever bother becoming an alderman. But like William Woolworth, they realised that with this renewal of war and the barring of English wool exports, it was imperative for them to acquire what political influence they could over the government of London. In February 1369, John Ward becomes the second grocer to be elected to the Court of Aldermen, and a third grocer, a young one, John Hadley, was elected to the Parliament of the following month. So the Woolworth faction was made up of those who were desperate to preserve their livelihoods by somehow getting the Calais staple restored. It would be best to call them the Stapler faction, and they would be one group of the opposition to the Court faction. And to this faction now must be added the power and the influence of Nicholas Brembe, who had in 1365 simply been the greatest single wool exporter in the city. He and several others of his kind had never been identified with any one of the London professions, but had simply called themselves merchants or woolmen. And now suddenly they found they could no longer employ their capital in the export of wool, from which they'd been making their fortune for the last decade. Now, some sought to get into the Gascon wine trade, but Nicholas Brembe, in 1369, decided to make large-scale investments into the London property market. Investment in property made commercial sense at a time when the plague was emptying houses and reducing their prices, but there may have also been a political purpose behind his steady stream of purchases, which within a year or two, well, Brembe was building a massive estate of city properties and extensive lands, tenements and even manors out in Middlesex. Nicholas Brembe is an enigmatic figure. Usually he's portrayed in history, not without some validity it must be said, as the overbearing, oligarchical, violent and unscrupulous capitalist who opposed John de Northampton's more democratic faction of London politics. Brembe and Northampton's both share one thing in common. Their origins are basically unknown to any historian. Nicholas Brembe appears suddenly in the London customs records of 1365 as this very rich capitalist on a grand scale. And there is nothing to suggest how he acquired his money and his commercial connections. But this is not entirely strange. In a period where, when the Calais staple began, they were drawing to London ambitious provincial merchants and investors who seized the chance to exploit the city's preeminence in the wool trade. Brembe's partner, Thomas Alban, was one such newcomer who had acquired citizenship but was not resident in the city originally. Other newcomers in the court faction, such as John Payel and Richard Lyons, had done likewise. But what rooted Nicholas Brembe in the city was his buying of property and his marriage in 1369 to one of the four daughters and co-heiresses of the very rich vintner, John de Stodey. The marriage extended Brembe's political and commercial connections. It was also a symbol of wealth and success. You have to understand, Nicholas Brembe was a brilliant man. Maybe not a likeable one, but he was brilliant. Now married to a vintner's daughter with a fine estate of properties in London, Brembe played with the fact that the wool trade had brought him close to the grocers such as Fulk Harwood, William Barrett and John Aubrey. And it was almost certainly John Aubrey, the son of Andrew Aubrey, who played a key part in attracting men such as Brembe into closer ties with the grocers of Soper's Lane. Young Aubrey, who had joined the fraternity of St. Atheline in 1346 along with his father, had matured into an experienced merchant of wealth and standing, although he was, again, like many, unwilling to take part in London's government, like his father had. But his name constantly recurs in close association with leading grocers and members of the emergent stapler faction. He was the man who knew people, who introduced people to people, who helped new collections be made. Aubrey was the partner of another prominent wool merchant, William Barrett, with whom he traded to Portugal. He was also on familiar terms with Stody, and this connection inevitably brought him close to his son-in-law, Brembe. He and Nicholas Brembe were both elected constables of the Westminster Staple in 1373. It seems that, like Walworth before him, that he should seek office. He'd become an alderman in 1370 because of his conviction that the staplers needed political strength to protect their trade. And by getting to know people, he increased the number of staplers. By controlling the court of the aldermen, the staplers hold to combat the influence of Pesci, Pyle and Bury, the court faction, and bring financial pressure onto the king to adopt policies more favourable to their interests. Nicholas Brembe was right amidst them. But to these two factions now comes a third faction, as we've hinted about earlier. This faction was led by John de Northampton. You see, this renewal of the war fanned the fears and discontents of other Londoners, not just the rich dudes who would go on to become aldermen. These were London craftsmen who really didn't give a rat's ass about the Calais staple, but did care deeply about the increased competition they suffered at home as a result of London losing its franchise. These men found a voice and a political programme offering direct action in a group led by John de Northampton, his fellow draper William Essex, and the mercers John Moore and Richard Norbury. What linked the grievances of these men with those of the wool merchants was the realisation that all the time the English merchants were banned from exporting wool, the import and distributive trade was in danger of total foreign domination, since the foreigners were attracted to London in even greater numbers by the renewed monopoly of the wool exports. They were bound to take over more and more goods to sell to pay for their purchases. They would soon dominate the retail and distributive trade as well as the import trade. These fears proved to be only too well founded. Alien imports increased by a third in 1371 to 1372, and the much-hated Nicholas Sarducci was prominent amongst the importers of silk and mercury. Other foreign merchants shipped cloth, skin, furs, wax, spices, and other royal materials. London's mercers, drapers, and skinners, as well as fishmongers and grocers, saw their professions in jeopardy. After nearly 20 years of petitioning in Parliament for the restoration of the franchise, there were now many citizens who saw little prospect of changing royal policy by legal means. Northampton already shown his preference for violence, and in the streets of London there was a growing, smouldering anger to exploit. In the summer of 1369, if you remember, the plague had returned with renewed virulence. And that not only brought death, but demoralised everyone and once again caused prices to rise. And then on the 16th of June that year came the pardoning of Nicholas Sarducci and the King's orders to the sheriffs of London that his goods were to be returned to him and he was not to be molested again. Rowdy apprentices and disgruntled retailers had been obstructing and insulting Italians in London for years, but when royal favour was so blatantly shown to a man who was notorious throughout the city for his frauds, things kicked off, and the mayor and the aldermen must have basically considered themselves lucky that they had to bind over and keep the peace on the 18th of July only 6 drapers and 4 mercers, led by John de Northampton, John Moore and Robert Norbury. These, though, were the ringleaders of the fury. How large their following had been is actually impossible to say. There was much, obviously, then, in 1369, to attract younger grocers to Northampton's following. Northampton and his friends were only expressing in direct action what most other Londoners were feeling. But call his faction the Radical Faction. So now you have 3 political parties in London. The Court Faction, the Staplers, and the more violent Radical Faction. Just before Christmas, 1370, Nicholas Sarducci was stabbed to death in Cheapside in a quarrel with some mercers. The murder was undoubtedly welcome news to the Londoners, and the strength of popular support for the murderers was probably what led to the king pardoning all three of them in 1371. The grocers were probably as glad as the mercers at his death, but the fragile alliance between the staplers and the London radicals was immediately threatened, because in August 1370, English merchants were allowed once again to export wool to Calais. But the Crown also resorted from December 1371 to the money-making scheme of selling licenses to anybody to evade the Calais staple. By this means, money was raised for the war, but it also made the restoration of the Calais staple completely pointless. And because of this, it was inevitable that wool exporters amongst the grocers would move to support the radical group. In September 1370, one grocer, Adam Carlyle, joined William Essex and the mercer, John Fifthide, on a panel which had been set up by the City of London to hear complaints against usurers. There it can be no doubt that the usurers the city had in mind were mostly of Italian origin. Popular hostility towards the Italians and to taxation for the war was also threatening the city's 1370 mayoral elections. The king reacted to this by ordering that only the better class of citizens should be allowed to take part in the election, and a mercer, John Burns, was chosen. At this, William Essex, along with the mercer Adam Stable and a prominent skinner, Elias de Thorpe, now began to give a new direction to the radical movement. For the first time, they made the crown, the protector of these foreigners, their political target. The three of them were accused with another Londoner of threatening a jury in a case that affected the interests of the Crown. Significantly, however, William Essex's opposition to the Crown in 1370 did not lose him the friendship of prominent grocers. On the contrary, he and John de Northampton produced both John Aubrey and William Venner as guarantors when they acquired a lease on two shops in the parish of St. Mary in the Bow in November 1370. Both Northampton and Essex lived in Bow Lane in Cordwainer Ward, which made them near neighbours of the grocers in Soper's Lane. Essex's growing popularity in the city generally can be seen by his election as a member of the Commons in 1371. With him were elected three staplers, who included Bartholomew Festing, the grocer. The four London members undoubtedly had much to do with presenting in that parliament two petitions on behalf of the merchant class. One protested against the alien domination of the wool trade, and the other was one of the strongest petitions yet made for the restoration of the London franchise. The petitions were more vehement because the king had announced before Parliament that he had made a new treaty with the Genoese in return for their naval support against France. The announcements had only one meaning for the grocers, that the Genoese would be inevitably looking to increase their direct shipping of goods and importing of products to Southampton. This is possibly what Geoffrey Chaucer had been to Genoa to discuss in 1372. This was a threat that seems to have drawn young grocers such as John Hadley closer to radicals like William Essex, and the radical group now gathered around him. There was unrest and rebelliousness growing amidst not just the tradesmen of the city, but amongst the mercantile class. And this was going on while there was a national sense of anger and frustration towards the decisions made by the court around the king. And for London, all of this meant that anger spilled into violence. There were serious disturbances, hints of very angry violence, which led to the king on the 5th of May 1371 to summon the mayor and aldermen to meet him in Guildford in the company of four or more leading men of each of the crafts. But the seriousness of the disorders in the city was so great, well, that becomes apparent from the protests that the mayor, John Burns, and the aldermen made, that their absence from the city would only provoke another breakdown in law and order. Nevertheless, they did obey the summons. The king made them swear under the heaviest of penalties to do their utmost to keep the peace. Within a few days, the king ordered John Hadley, William Essex, John de Northampton, John Moore, and eight other Londoners to be imprisoned in the Tower of London. Later, they were dispersed to various royal castles throughout the realm, probably so they would not serve as a rallying point for more disorders. John de Northampton's name appears as that of a ringleader. John Hanley, however, was managed to be bailed by six men who either already called themselves grocer or who were soon to join the grocer's company. Mercers, drapers, skinners and fishmongers appear amongst the bailers of the other prisoners. All the leading mercantile businesses basically seem to be giving behind-the-scenes support to the radical faction to oppose the court faction's policies. And in this light, suddenly, that tale of the blacksmith's apprentice, Nicholas Mullary, which we covered last chapter, who'd been condemned to the pillory for spreading reports that merchant strangers were to be allowed as freely as the citizens, he was basically probably expressing the common view on the street. This also explains why more and more crafts and professions at this time registered articles and appointed surveyors and made rules to make it more difficult for foreigners or the unfree to compete in their trade. That November, the collection of the city share for the war subsidy stirred up more trouble, and John de Northampton's brother, William Cumberton, led an affray in protest outside the mayor's house. However, what was stunning the wool merchants and then galvanising him to supporting this activity were the victories of the French in 1372, which culminated in June with a massive naval disaster of La Rochelle. The king arranged for the wine fleet that year to be convoyed by fighting ships, but there were no naval forces available to protect the wool fleet. The king urgently ordered towns to build barges at their own expense, and London was made responsible for building too. By the summer of 1373, a strong naval force was again put into the English Channel, but during the intervening months, the anxieties of the wool exporters were intense. Also in 1372, no fewer than 24 merchant ships were commandeered for royal service, and their crews were detained for long periods of time unpaid. Those wool merchants of London, whose success depended on the continuance of the Calais staple, found themselves threatened on all sides. Only a strong organisation could help them survive. And here is Nicholas Brembe, who'd experienced with his father-in-law, Stody, of corporate or joint stock undertaking amongst the Vintners back in the 1360s. He saw that the immediate need was to galvanise London's government to defend the city, the staple and the sea lanes. He and Philpot determined to challenge the inert and divided court of aldermen from within its own ranks. Disorder on the streets was helping their cause. It seems likely that the faction led by the mercers and the drapers, who were most hostile to the policies of the royal court, made it possible for Brembe and Philpot to be elected together on the 21st of September as sheriffs and aldermen. Two aldermen had to resign for that to be possible, in an era where normally they served till death or old age. One of those who did resign was the long-serving draper, Stephen de Cavendish. Mayor Barnes also had the right to nominate one of the sheriffs and must have therefore have chosen either Philpot or Brembe. On the 13th of October, another mercer, John Pale, the friend of Brembe, was chosen as mayor. The mercers, the drapers and the grocers, therefore, in 1372, really do seem to be acting in cooperation. And it's about now the fraternity of St. Atheline becomes the Company of Grocers. There was a remarkable expansion in the membership in the year following. In June 1373, 54 more men, including two priests, joined the Company of Grocers. And again, almost half of them were the exporting class. In 1374, the grocers made a determined bid to increase their representation on the court of the aldermen. They seem to have been helped not only by their stapler allies amongst the fishmongers, but also by Northampton's radical drapers. In July 1374, the grocer Robert Hatfield took the place of a fishmonger as alderman of Candlewick Street. And in March 1375, John Hadley took another fishmonger's place as alderman of Tower. In the following August, John Marins took the place of a draper in Cripplegate Ward, and in the same month, John de Northampton became the alderman of Cordwainder. Now, it's probably impossible that he could have been elected without the support of the grocers and Soper's Lane. Also, their support probably helped him win, as his second wife, the wealthy heiress of a roper, John de Preston, whose relation, Richard, was one of the most prominent members of the grocers' company. How much the drapers as a group contributed to his election is difficult to say, It was probably at this period and under this influence that the Drapers moved their fraternity to his parish church of St. Mary Le Bow, which had become the centre of his operations in the years to come. In 1374, William Woolworth, the instigator of the Staplers faction, was elected mayor in the city, and in October 1375, the grocer John Ward was elected mayor after him. At this point, six grocers held aldermanries, and they could count with the support also of Brembe's father-in-law, the vintner Stodeley, his friend Philpot, three of the four fishmongers, and the two drapers. This gave them a slender majority in the court, and it was sufficient to allow Mayor Ward issue a proclamation in February 1376, which made it impossible for foreigners to act as brokers unless they were elected by four men of a London local company which they were to serve. The move was followed by prosecutions of Italians as acting as brokers for illegal loans. The panel appointed to hear these cases demonstrates an unmistakable alliance between the Staplers, the Grocers, and John de Northampton's group. It was composed of three aldermen, the grocer and mayor, John Ward, the fishmonger and stapler, William Woolworth, and John de Northampton, a grocer, a stapler, and a radical. This was an alliance united behind a single common cause, London as one, working against the interests of the self-serving Crown faction. This was what was going on in London, just as in early 1376 the King was forced, by the desperate state of his finances, to summon another Parliament. And as the Knights of the Shires and Provincial Burgesses travelled to Westminster to attend this Parliament, they were joined by the London MPs, William Woolworth, William Essex, and the grocer Adam Carlyle. And they were the ones who were attending the Good Parliament. The Good Parliament began in Westminster on the 28th of April 1376. King Edward remained at Havering and did not attend except for the opening ceremony. Nor did the Prince of Wales attend, as he was physically too weak for business of any sort. So it fell to the King's middling son, John of Gaunt, to represent the royal family in the Painted Chambers as the magnates, clergy and knights of the shires gathered for the first time in 2.5 years. King Edward, so obvious by his absence, immediately became the subject of debate. The Good Parliament began almost straight away with a powerful move to condemn what was going on in the court. The leadership of the Commons fell really to the first ever Speaker of the House of Commons, Sir Peter Delamere. And the word which Delamere used more often than any other to describe the self-seekers around King Edward was coven. Coven. He used this to galvanise the support of members of Parliament, including the London ones, and seize the political initiative. So when the Commons met and flatly refused to raise any taxes, they were in a strong position indeed. And when John of Gaunt realised that their motive in refusing was a concerted will to move against those who they felt were poorly advising the king, he was furious. It is impossible not to be impressed by Delamere's courage. With death threats being muttered around him and John of Gaunt steaming in his pent-up fury, Delamere proceeded to accuse Chancellor Latimer of a string of crimes. One stands out as Delamere accused him, along with the London merchant and master of the Royal Mint, Richard Leon, of taking interest from the Treasury for money that had been given by foreign merchants to the Crown. Both were also charged with sequestering imported goods for sale through price-fixing monopolies. The immediate dismissal of Latimer was demanded as an absolute condition, as well as that of Leon. Some called for them to be executed. They impeached Richard Leon, Adam de Burries and John Peckey, which crippled the court party in the City of London. The London MPs were probably clearly responsible for a petition that all Italians or Lombards who had no other trade than that of a broker should be banished from the kingdom, as they were guilty of usury. They also brought pressure to bear for the ending of all licences to evade the Staples, and petitioned once again for the franchise to be restored on the grounds that the city had become impoverished. This parliamentary onslaught against the royal government seems to have been reinforced by violence in London. At the end of May, a proclamation was issued against the carrying of arms and the wandering about night after curfew. The aldermen of London were called upon to mount armed guards in each ward to preserve the peace. There is no proof that John de Northampton was organising all of this, but it does seem to match his pattern that he would. John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster, could hardly have been unaware that a similar combination of violence in the streets of London and a determined parliament had overthrown his grandfather, Edward II. Stubborn and arrogant though he was, he had the sense to see that unless concessions were made, not only would the government be refused the money it needed, but the crown itself might be in trouble. He therefore ordered an adjournment, but he started horse trading to make a deal. King Edward remained largely unaware of the proceedings that were going on in Westminster. The impeachment of those three London aldermen meant that the power in the city had passed to the alliance which had been created between the Staplers and Northampton's followers. The Staplers were the more numerous and also the more moneyed group, and the court bowed to their demands. On the 24th of July, the government announced that no more licences would be issued to evade the Calais Staples. This was victory. But as to the other larger issue of London getting all its traditional rights back, there was nothing. I mean, the signs had been there. The Crown had earlier signified its assent to the city's petition for its restoration. But that announcement in July gave good news to the Staplers, but nothing to the Radicals. To John de Northampton and William Essex, there was only one explanation for the delay and prevarication. They had been betrayed by the Staplers. The wool merchants had got what they wanted at the cost of giving up their support for the recovery of the city franchise. Once the monopoly of the Calais Staples was restored, they could compete with the foreigners on their own terms, and they could survive without the franchise of London. But for the mercers who needed the franchise back, and for Northampton's drapers, the fruits of the good Parliament were bitterness and frustration. This very quickly bred a hatred towards their former allies, the Staplers. Within days of the announcement of the restoration of the Calais Staples, John de Northampton and William Essex had organised many of the men who supported them in a reaction. But as the city boiled in fury, as the Staplers had broken this alliance with the Radicals, we need to pause. I'll come back to London, but I'm going to end this episode by lifting our heads and looking at the wider picture. What was happening with the aging king while all of this was going on? He had no idea what was going on. King Edward had heard little or nothing about the total of 60 serious charges brought against Latimer and Lord Neville until they were dismissed from their offices, arrested, and all their possessions confiscated. Richard Story, one of Edward's chamber knights, came to tell the king of their plight and to plead for his friends. He phrased the news in a way calculated to cause King Edward maximum distress. Parliament was seeking the king's deposition, he told them. They were trying to do to him what they'd done to his father. Deposition with dishonour is what King Edward had dreaded all his life, and yet now in his feeble-minded state he saw his worst nightmare coming true. He sought advice, and he was told to take immediate action to stop the proceedings in Parliament. That would have been very dangerous, and Edward knew it. So what could he do? His distress was exasperated when it emerged that Alice was being implicated in the accusations levelled against his officers. He saw himself losing those few people he trusted, being separated from the one woman he now loved, and he himself losing the crown. He saw himself being left alone. He implored those with him to take him to Kennington to see his son, the Prince, to consult with the Prince of Wales. But what he saw there must have torn his heart in two, because when he arrived at his son's palace, he found him dying. The disease which had debilitated the Prince for the last 7 years was now about to claim his life. The sight of his bedridden son in agony can only have added to Edward's pains. He'd already buried 7 of his children. It was now time he would bury his 8th, his favourite. Edward ordered the prince to be taken to Westminster, where he could spend the final days together before watching his son die in his chambers at the Palace of Westminster on the 8th of June. Across the nation, the outpouring of grief was genuine and extreme. But nowhere was the death of the prince more keenly felt than in Edward. He had lost his protector, his son and heir, his last hope for the future. Edward was in mourning, grief-stricken and hardly able to communicate with the rest of the world. So we can only guess how he greeted the news that Parliament had moved against Alice Perez. Sir Peter de la Mare informed Parliament that she'd relieve the royal purse of between £2,000 and £3,000 a year. Added to this, Parliament stipulated that she and all women who would be prohibited from protecting those accused in the King's Court. And then it was revealed she had secretly married William Windsor. And as a marriage had to be consummated, it was universally assumed, and probably true, that they had slept together. It was shocking, appalling. Had she not been Edward's mistress, impeachment would have surely followed. But Alice avoided prison and further prosecution on condition that she was no longer allowed to visit or see the king. If she did see him, she would lose everything she possessed and suffer perpetual exile. Hence, we can be fairly sure there came a day when Edward expected Alice to be with him and ask for her, and he would have been told that his beloved mistress, his Lady of the Sun, could not be brought to him. He'd never see her again. She had been married to another man. King Edward had been committing adultery. This was a huge blow for Edward. The loss, personal and emotional, hurt him deeply. Also the sinfulness, even though he loved her in good faith. He was lonely and afraid. In a sorrowful scene, he swore an oath to the Virgin Mary that he did not know she was married. In his confused and lamentable state, he begged for Parliament to show her mercy, not to have her executed, both out of love for him and to preserve some vestige of his honour. Amongst the resolutions of the good Parliament was a declaration that a council of 12 should advise the King on all matters of weight, thereby reducing the risk of a coven appropriating royal power again. Edward sank into a mood of unfocused remorse and grief. Visitors came to see him and went. Some Florentines in exile persuaded him to give them somewhere to stay in London, despite a sentence of excommunication hanging over them. The Duke of Brittany left the country without informing him. He didn't care. He was now waiting for just two things: the burial of his son, which would take place on October the 5th, and his own death. At the end of September, Edward fell ill at Havering. All his physicians despaired of his recovery. Letters were sent out to the clergy on the 2nd of October, asking him to pray for the king. On the 5th of October, the day of his son's funeral, he appointed trustees to look after his estate. That same day, he made his will. Everyone thought this was it. Edward did sort out the inheritance of the throne. After his death, only males were to inherit. First, young Prince Richard, then John of Gaunt and his sons, and then, failing them, Edmund and his sons, and finally Thomas and his sons. In the 14th century, wills were normally only made when the sufferer genuinely feared death was close. Thus, everyone around him now believed that Edward was about to die. Latimer, who Edward had appointed one of his executors, was recalled and pardoned. Alice, too, returned to the court at his request, with the Council of 12 to guard against any corruption and Latimer and Neville's safety out of office. It was felt that the great king should be allowed some last wishes on his final days. On the 16th of October, a long gown was ordered for him to guard against the cold weather. More warm clothes lined with lambskin and furs were ordered 3 days later. And 3 days after that, despite so shamefully betraying him, Alice returned to him and received his pardon. And then he lasted 8 more months. 8 long months, a lamentable tale of poor health deteriorating further and the country sliding into greater political acrimony and hatred. I mean, had he died shortly after his will, no one would have begrudged having Alice at his bedside. But that she was so easily restored to him and remained for him for the next 8 months caused scandal. Parliament's will was being flouted. What had changed? Latimer was with the king, and John of Gaunt was now hunting down the key figures from the good Parliament. Peter de la Mare was arrested and flung into dungeon. All those who had led the Parliament seemed to be becoming under persecution from their king's son and supporters. In November, Alice tried to secure Edward's pardon for Richard Leon. Apparently, the story goes that Edward's new chamberlain, Roger Beauchamp, would not let her near the king, but as she made such a commotion outside, Edward heard her, shuffled to the door, opened it, accepted the position, and there was nothing Beauchamp could do to stop him reading it. In his simple state, he pardoned Leon. Edward remained at Havering for the rest of the year. On his 64th and final birthday, he gave presents of lavish robes to his 7 serving physicians and surgeons. On January 25th, 1377, he completed his 50th year as king. The jubilee was not wildly celebrated. A general pardon was announced. By February, he was transported by barge to his palace at Sheen to be nearer to Windsor. Like his mother in her dying, it became his ambition to attend one last ceremony of the Order of the Garter. As his boat passed Westminster, all the lords who were there attending Parliament in the presence of his grandson came out to wave and cheer him. In that Parliament, clergymen were once again being appointed to great offices of state, the impeachments of the previous Parliament were being overturned, and parliamentary business was beginning to resume the character of bitter infighting and political factions it had known under Edward II. The carnage and instability of the reign of Edward II had returned to haunt England once again. Edward III did manage to attend one more St. George's Day celebrations at Windsor. On the 23rd of April 1377, he lifted a sword to dub the heirs to the great titles of the kingdom. Before him knelt his 2 10-year-old grandsons, Richard of Bordeaux, heir of the late Prince of Wales, and Henry of Bolingbroke, son and heir of John of Gaunt. Both of these boys were nominated for the Order of the Garter. Oh, Edward also knighted his younger son, 12-year-old Thomas of Woodstock, and the young heirs to several other earldoms and baronies. He also knighted his own illegitimate son, John Southeray, which gave Alice her moment of vindication. Edward was taken back to his palace at Sheen to die. Few visited him. The release for which King Edward must have yearned for finally came at midsummer. On the 2nd of June, he made preparations to commemorate the anniversary of his son's, the prince's, death. On the 4th, he granted his last charter. With him that day were his 2 younger sons and Nicholas Carew, Henry Percy, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and his treasurer and chandler. Then they left him in his chamber to listen to the silence. Alice alone remained with him, together with a few household staff and chamber knights. In his bed he talked of hunting and hawking and the joys he had known, and then, suddenly, he lost the power of speech. He had almost certainly suffered a stroke. He lay in his bed, unable to say or do anything. Alice was with him, and a priest also. According to one source, Alice removed the rings from his fingers before she left. He was drifting into oblivion, which consumed everything he truly loved. At the last, after Alice had departed, only a priest remained. This great king lay there. There were no earls or dukes or princes or queens, no sons, no wife, not even his mistress. There were no ambassadors, no dignitaries, no trumpets. There was just the dust floating in the air of the chamber, and one priest praying at his side. Supposedly, the story goes, the priest urged him to repent of his sins, and therefore he alone heard the dying king whisper his final words, "Jesus, have pity." The king was dead. And back in London, all hell was breaking loose. Cover that next chapter. Thanks for listening. Story of London returns next week for another chapter in this incredible story. All right, see you then. Bye.